Good evening. We're grateful for the presence of all who are here tonight in the house of the Lord. I want to talk this evening about the faith of an atheist. The faith of an atheist. But before I do so, I want to talk about the death of Dr. Death, Dr. Jack Kevorkian, back in 2011 to lead in. Dr. Kevorkian was famously nicknamed Dr. Death for his invention of the suicide machine and his participation in at least 130 physician-assisted suicides. He passed away in 2011 from health complications. He was once on the cover of Time magazine, and a movie was done about him starring Al Pacino as Jack Kevorkian, called You Don't Know Jack, which I have not seen. And for those who heard him on TV interviews, and there were several, you'd recall that he was well known for his harangues expressing great frustration against a government that prevented euthanasia. To Dr. Kevorkian, the U.S. government was a tyrant and people were sheep. Religion, he said, would just keep your mind in a straight jacket. He was a rather pessimistic fellow, quite suspicious, and he allowed his cynicism to lead him to mass murder on a scale to rival the Oklahoma City bombing in deaths. Now, he was equally clear in promoting atheism. In an interview on Fox News with Neil Cavuto on September 2, 2009, he admitted, "I never believed in God." And when asked by Neil what happens at death, his answer, "One is going to stink for a while and go into the ground." And if one truly does not believe in God or an afterlife, there is no legitimate standard to live by. So perhaps that helped him to rationalize assisted suicide. The Bible, on the other hand, will teach us that life has purpose. Man has a reason for being here on this globe. And life is full of meaning. Serve the Lord your God with joy and gladness. Deuteronomy 28, verse 47. God created man with an eternal soul. We have been made there in His image. We've been made so as to have fellowship with the Almighty. And He breathed into mankind, into the nostrils, the breath of life, and man became a living soul. And the Apostle Paul tells us in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, that we are created by God in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. Kevorkian, on the other hand, confessed that if he had been given an option, he would have chosen not to be born. In that interview with Cavuto, the question was raised, "What about your view on life? You sound like a very depressed guy on life itself. You said that with all its hardships and with all its tediousness, life itself is not worth living." He replied, "Well, I'm not the only one to say that. Some philosophers have said it. I had a young girl in her early teens who wrote and said, 'I just don't want to be here. I felt this way all my life.' And she's been through all kinds of psychiatric treatment and diagnosis, had even convulsive therapy. It didn't help. She says, 'I'm not depressed. I don't have any pain. I do not want to be here.' Now, what do you do with a case like that?" And we are left to wonder and worry at what exactly Dr. Kevorkian would have counseled in her case. According to his philosophy, perhaps she should just give it up and be put to sleep, give her a big dose of the death cocktail and let her go, let her slip away. The Bible gives us an entirely different outlook. Yes, we should all be longing for heaven, but we are here by God's design and by God's divine will and decree. And it is our job to live with focus and enthusiasm so as to fulfill His purpose for us. I'm reminded of several passages, but what comes to my mind would be that life has consequences, and indeed it is appointed unto men to die once, but then comes the judgment. Over and over, Kevorkian emphasized derogatorily that religion was used just to control us. Religion was to him mythology, and he was emphatic that he would never allow such to dictate his actions. He said in that interview, "All I know is that I do not believe in mythology. I do not accept mythology as a basis for my actions or a basis for law, and we are a society based on mythology." Well, the Bible describes that the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. Ecclesiastes 12, verse 7. And so the wise man challenges us all to be prudent and to be astute and observant, to walk circumspectly, to use the language of the Apostle Paul. The wise men said, "Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter." In other words, this is what life is going to really be all about. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether it be good or evil. And the bottom line is that disbelieving in God will not change the fact that we must all answer to Him one day. But atheism denies that we have significance, that we have relevance. Now, the faith of an atheist, he has a form of faith, though it is not the faith that is pleasing to the Lord. Biblically speaking, faith, pleasing faith, is defined in Scripture. The classic text would be Hebrews chapter 11, verse 1. Now, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Faith concerns conviction, belief, and expectations. It is based on demonstrable facts. Now, no man has seen God at any time. Yes, we're aware of that. John chapter 1, 18 and 1 John 4, 12 mentions that no one has seen God. But we know that He exists based on the world of His making. A la Romans 1:20. "For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead." So that what? So that they, the infidels, the unbelievers, are without excuse. Now, biblically, that depicts faith, doesn't it? In Hebrews 11, verse 1. Yet if you were to consult the dictionary, we're not naive. We know that we would get a rather different answer for the normal or typical usage. This is yourdictionary.com, an online dictionary. And look at what they say for the very first definition for faith. Number one, unquestioning belief that does not require proof or evidence. And the reason that this happens to be the first definition listed and provided is because that's basically how people tend to use it. They just talk about a leap of faith. You don't really know what you're doing, but just hop on out there. But in the Bible, evidence is always forthcoming. It's just a question of what form that evidence is going to take. If one means that we must be able to see God directly, that we have to have a physical manifestation to know that He's out there, that He has to open up the roof here, for instance, and just peel back the ceiling and lean in and take a peek, then that type of evidence shall not emerge, not on this side of eternity as far as I know. But since when has the definition been so limited? If evidence can be whatever it is that we can see, hear, touch, and handle, whatever it is that we can properly conclude with the mind that God has blessed us with, then the answer is yes, we have more than enough evidence, more than enough proof that touches on the existence of God. So you see, this is a misnomer when looking there at that first definition with this lexicon. It is just a question of what form evidence is supposed to take. You know, I cannot see the one who happened to make this lectern, but this lectern is here on this platform. It's visible. It can be touched. It can be heard when we knock on it. This is evidence. Now, I can believe that all of this just happened, or I can believe that someone made this. It's just an issue of what is more reasonable to believe. Now, faith is often a religious word used in a religious context, but I call your attention here to the fourth definition that they list. Just anything believed. All right, that's pretty broad. And inasmuch as that is a usage, we can talk about the faith of an atheist legitimately. He believes God does not exist. That happens to be his faith. But watch this closely. The way that he wants to present things is very divergent and conflicting. The infidel wants to create a contrast that would suggest that he is looking at the evidence while you happen to not be. So he'd say, why, you can take the road of faith, or you can go on the road of reason and rationale and sensible thinking. You can be practical. There are two streets here. So he says, why, if you're religious, you're going to be walking by faith, then you see, you're just superstitious. Why, you believe in Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny and the Tooth Fairy, and you also believe in God, and they'll make fun of all of that. But see, over here, I live by reason. I live by science. I live by logic. And this is the distance between the two, the measure, insofar as many are concerned. And as a result, Christians are often made to feel inferior. You see, over there at the Lawrenceville Church of Christ, you have that which just makes you feel very comfortable and makes you feel good about yourselves and you're important and you have your hopes and you have your aspirations. But atheists, why, they are arbiters of reason. They live in the real world. And you in the church, you're just off in Never Never Land, the land of make-believe. You're there with Peter Pan and the Lost Boys running from Captain Hook. Well, if we are in this world, be it understood, we all witness the very same phenomenon. We all have the same evidence. We just have to ask, what is more practical to accept? But here's a poster for atheism, looking at the cosmos. It tells us that reality is awesome. So you see the implication? Why, they over there, they're living in the, quote, real world, whereas religious people are not. They're just in denial. And here is an advertisement from the American Atheist Program put out there during the holiday season. It announces, you know, it's a myth. Talking there about the birth of Christ. And as a caption it has, this season celebrate reason. And they're rather militant about all of this here. Here's an atheist bus campaign saying there's probably no God. And now stop worrying and enjoy your life. And here's another advertisement from livingwithoutreligion.org. You don't need God to hope, to care, to love, to live. And what a wonderful, beautiful picture of a family they've portrayed right there, haven't they? So you people, you just need to get a life. You need to get real. You take that program, House, Dr. House. I heard someone refer to him as Dr. Outhouse. He said, if you could reason with religious people, there would be no religious people. So we hear all of this and we ask now, is this so? Are atheists rational and am I irrational? Here's a sign that says adults with imaginary friends are stupid. And we see a stick man at a garbage can dropping all religious symbols there into the waste basket. Now, despite the air of arrogance and boastful claims, do you realize that atheism is a system of faith? It is. Now, they're not going to like hearing that, but it's so. We're going to see, though, what is more legitimate to believe. But atheism is a system of faith. Let's illustrate this right over here. They believe, but they cannot prove, that God does not exist. They accept that by faith. He cannot prove that. There's a man by the name of Richard Dawkins, very outspoken on this subject. He is a premier speaker about atheism, bar none. I mean, he is just tops as far as that community is concerned. He's an evolutionary biologist at Oxford. He's been on TV, and he ridicules the idea of belief in God. He wrote a book called The God Delusion, And as a result of this, some of the young people, as they pick this up and pour through the pages, they read this material that Dawkins puts out, and they're influenced by this. And they say, you know what? I don't want to be an ignoramus like Mom and Dad over there in the Bible Belt. I'm out. But before one does that, let's just stress that Dawkins reaches his conclusions by faith. He reaches his understanding and lives his life by a form of faith. So, you see, you take the atheist who says, rather dogmatically and defiantly, I know God does not exist. I know that he's not out there. Now, they say that long and loud. But do you realize that for that statement to be true, for that statement to be correct, for the person who says, I know for a fact God does not exist, what he's telling you is that he knows everything, and he's having to say, in essence, that he has been everywhere. Like that song by Hank Snow, I've been everywhere, man. Cross the deserts, bear man. Breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel, I've had my share, man. I mean, you name it, he's been there. I've seen everything there is to see. I've been present there at the creation, at the beginning of this world. I'll be present there at the end of this world. I know all that there is to know, and I can tell you, go ahead now. Here's the spoiler. There is no God. You see, in essence, he's made himself God. Now, if he suddenly admits, well, no, I don't know everything that there is to know. I haven't been everywhere that there is to go. That just isn't so. Then isn't it possible that one fact or one feature he might have overlooked is that God exists? Christians look around. We witness the fingerprint of the Almighty everywhere. Psalm 19, verse 1, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Evidence is there. Whether you're talking about the exploration of human biology or doing some stargazing, all of that can illustrate creation. You just watch some of those nature programs. Take, for instance, the eels that live off the eastern coast of America. And there are eels also that are off of the coasts over there in Europe. And did you know that they have migratory patterns that they follow? They're going to make treks every year to go down to the depths of the sea south of Bermuda. And they will have their young, and the adults will die there. And when the young ones get old enough, do you know what they're going to do? If their parents came from the sea off the coast of America, that's exactly where they migrate back to. Or if they came there from the coasts of Europe, that's exactly where they'll head out. And they do not get it mixed up. Now, how do they know to do that? Who taught them? You see, this shows the power of God in the creation of instinct. And we could talk all day about behavioral patterns of salmon or sea turtles or the flights of monarch butterflies. It just shows that the animal kingdom declares the handiwork of God. And you could read much more about that in Bird, Butterfly, and Eel by James Prosek. Yet even those like Dawkins begin to hedge their bet just a little bit in contemplation of realities just like this. Yeah, you see, they allow themselves to be put into a box, as a matter of fact. You see, Richard Dawkins here said, I cannot know for certain, but I think God is very improbable, and I live my life under the assumption that he is not there. You see the backpedaling that takes place? I like this definition of atheism. The belief that there was nothing, and nothing happened to nothing, and then nothing magically exploded for no reason, creating everything, and then a bunch of everything magically rearranged itself for no reason whatsoever into self-replicating bits, which then turned into dinosaurs, makes perfect sense. Well, they accept all of that by faith. And they ridicule us for believing in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. In a way, don't you see how this is a, quote, greater miracle? Nothing there to prove their hypothesis. This is outlandish to the nth degree. takes greater faith to be an atheist, doesn't it? They would also say that the greater comes from the lesser. Matter appeared, matter evolved or changed, and man evolved from matter, and then the concept of God came from mankind. So God did not create man, but man created God, they say. Now, what's more reasonable? Mind over matter or matter over mind? And this concept of evolution from matter violates one of the fundamental scientific laws that physicists and astronomers have understood for centuries. I mean, this violates the second law of thermodynamics. Atheism sets all of that there on its ears. You see, this law teaches that everything is constantly breaking down over time. That's to say, it's in a state of deterioration. A great example might be there, say, with a house. Unless you put in the time, unless you put in the muscle for upkeep and maintenance, what's going to happen? It shall fall to pieces. It will go to the critters and rodents and bats. Now, that is a law of science, a rule, but you see, they are speaking out against this in the promotion of their idea that life itself has come from this vacuum of nothingness on its own. And you see, oh, it started simple, but it grew and grew and grew until it became infinitely complex. Dear ones, order does not come from disorder on its own. Rather, we see just the opposite. I'll tell you what else he accepts by faith. He believes in spontaneous generation. That is, that life came from non-life. That which was not alive produced that which is alive. Now, does life just poof, come out of thin air? Is that scientific? It was Francisco Redi in the 1600s who officially disproved this. Now, this happened to perplex people for a long, long time. An animal would die out there in the field, say like a cow, and after a little time, maggots would be there. And so people started to scratch their heads. What exactly is happening here? And from this carcass, do we actually see life? But an experiment was done where you had meat placed in a jar that was unsealed and meat placed in a jar that was sealed. And the meat placed there in a jar that was sealed never had maggots to appear in it. You see, because flies simply could not get in there to lay their eggs. And so you see, they woke up to this reality that life will not come from non-life. So you see, the evolutionist has some explaining to do here. Now they will say, oh, now we get all of that. We're abiding by that rule with just one exception. Just one exception, that's all that we're asking for, that it happened one time with the very first cell. Ladies and gentlemen, even with a single cell, and I can say this emphatically since I studied cell biology in college, even with a single cell, you have infinitely more information packed away and tucked away into it than you could ever find in the Library of Congress. It bears the mark of the Maker. Life from non-life has been disproved. There's nothing scientific about their claims. It is far more reasonable to believe in God. Hebrews 11, verse 6. He who comes to God must believe that He is, and that He is a rewarder of those who diligently seek Him. God's all-seeing eye is upon us. Will we do our part to walk by faith and live by faith, knowing that faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen? Hebrews chapter 3, verse 4. Every house is built by someone. I mean, that's just axiomatic. It's just plain as a proverb. But He who built all things is God. And God is the one to whom we shall answer. Truly, as the psalmist has said, In Psalm 14, verse 1, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Our faith needs to rest in God, in His holy word, and in the Lord Jesus Christ, who gives life to the dead, and shall come again and call all men from the grave, and call the righteous unto Himself. And the saved shall meet the Lord in the air, and thus we shall ever be with the Lord. So we comfort one another with those words. If you're not yet a Christian, we encourage you to become one. It is the gospel of Jesus Christ that is the power of God to our salvation. And make no mistake, we're going to reap. There shall come that harvest. Whatever man sows, that he shall also reap. So let us, of the Spirit, reap everlasting life. If we can help you toward that end, to obey the words of Jesus Christ, who said, he who believes and is baptized shall be saved, to be faithful until death, to have that crown of life, come now to the front while we stand and sing the song that has been announced.